What's going on? This is Hoppy Hour. I am your host, Ryan Hoppy. And from 670, The Score in Chicago, the one and only Matt Spiegel was on the show. What's going on, man?
Hey, Ryan. What's happening, man? How's it going down by you? I know you're not up here anymore.
It's going great, man. So I'm originally from Chicago. I grew up in Arlington Heights for 21 years, and 670 and B96 in its prime were like the two things that really defined me wanting to go into sports radio and going into radio overall. And so as I was saying to you off air, I used to listen to 670 in the library. I would listen to you and then B&B from like 2 to 2:50 until I would get out of class. And the funny part was, because of me listening to sports radio and watching March Madness on CBS TV 11 years ago, I actually got everything banned in the library. So because of you and 670 at John Hersey, they can no longer have fun unless they changed it.
Oh, my God. You know what? I'm not going to take that blame. I was just living my life, doing my thing, man. That is you as the conduit.
Yeah.
And you're the reason that they're not allowed to have fun anymore. But, no, man, I love that because, like, we all have our moment, right? We all have our moment, and we all have, like, that show or that radio sound that made us get into it that was like, oh, that sounds like fun or that feels like fun. So the fact, like, that I could be any part of that for you is just awesome. Love it.
And I think what really meant a lot to me in Chicago radio was it was like a voice you could turn to, because this was around the Jay Cutler era. So I could turn to you guys to just rip into him or sort of give him props, because like I'm never able to really trust the national media because I don't know what they're saying. But man, you guys and all the shows, it was like comfort if he were to throw four interceptions against the Panthers or whatnot.
Well, we lived it. We lived it every day, right? We saw that dude. And so we went to the violent ups and downs that dude's play brought out for us in conversation. I was in Green Bay with Dan McNeil working and was at the game, his first game against the Packers at Lambeau Field, when he turned it over a bunch of times.
Yeah.
It was just an absolute disaster. And the next morning, we were live from a bar there in Green Bay. And I turned to Mac during the show and I said, you know what? Cutler's going to have problems in this town. He said, why? I said, because he has jerk face. It's not because he is a jerk necessarily. It's because he has jerk face. He has like AJ Pierzynski face or Bill Lane Beer face. He just has that face that just drives you crazy. So whenever anything goes wrong, it makes it that much worse. And that's what it was like living with Jay, right? Like, and whenever anything went wrong, or whenever he was annoying, or the body language seemed worse, or even if Mike Martz was the problem, when he said, tell Martz I said F you, it came off bad for Cutler as well. It's just like he just had this intrinsically unlikable thing that kind of doomed him. Because when you actually look at the body of work and look at the volume of play, we'd kill for it. Most years, we'd frankly kill for it. That's how quarterback starved we are.
My idea about Jay is I think he was forced to play football. I think growing up, somebody told him he had to play because he never looked like he was having fun, man. I've seen worse quarterbacks with body language where they look like they're happy to be there. I don't know. I can't think of a name. Like, let's say Geno Smith. Like, they just seemed kind of happy to be there. But, man, Jay, even when he won, he was so passive-aggressive.
Yeah. No, it's true. And never forget that Jay's dad was the local sheriff. And so dad was in charge and dad was feared, and Jay grew up thinking that he should be in charge and also feared and just kind of didn't care about a lot of stuff. Just was very, very entitled there in Santa Claus, Indiana. And, you know, it's interesting. We all knew guys like that who didn't love the sport but were good enough. I remember there was this dude who was 6'8 in my high school who had no interest in basketball but just kept feeling pressured and pressured and pressured and finally did it and wasn't good. Just kind of got laughed at, but he was 6'8", so everybody thought he was supposed to do it. And it can wreak havoc on your life if you keep following that kind of stuff instead of actually what you want.
So when the news broke that the Bears got Andy Dalton, I was as mad as everybody else. I didn't think we were going to get Russell Wilson. I just didn't believe it. But Are there any positives to them signing him? Because I'm already kind of like in Bears purgatory because I've been removed from Chicago for 6 years that I haven't watched that many games, and Mitchell just made me mad. And I don't want to leave the team because it's the team I love, and like I feel like a bandwagoner watching the Buccaneers down here. But is there any optimism about Andy joining the team? Any?
Well, yeah, I think there is some because – it depends what your ceiling is, you know, like his ceiling, the ceiling of what the Bears can be is really, it's obviously capped. Like you're not going to be a Super Bowl champ. You're probably not going to be an NFC title game team, but could you be 9-7 and make the playoffs? Yeah. Could you go 10-6 and make the playoffs? Yeah, probably. Dalton's done that before. And I really believe they're going to have the simplified, streamlined version of the offense that Mitch Trubisky ran for the final 6-7 games of the year that was more Bill Lazor than Matt Nagy. I think you're going to have Nagy as the offensive coordinator and play caller, but it's going to be very streamlined. They're not going to ask Dalton to do a lot of the crazy stuff they were asking Mitch to do, stuff that Pat Mahomes gets asked to do. I think they're going to try to be the Tennessee Titans north, try to run the ball with David Montgomery, throw passes every once in a while, and hope the defense is strong and stout enough. But look, the defense in Tennessee isn't even that good. And still, every year, they're 9-7, 10-6, maybe 11-5, make the playoffs. And they all enter the playoffs, and we all know that Tennessee is not going to win the Super Bowl. We know it. And that's what the Bears are accepting to do. Now, most of the teams around the league will tell you that unless you have that quarterback who's going to make you special, that it's not an unsensible way to do business the way the Bears are doing it. It's just super unexciting. It's super uninspiring, and it's settling for a much lower ceiling than we all want and frankly we all deserve. So it's boring, but there is optimism in there if you can accept that a decent year that's fun to watch for the most part and gets you into the playoffs is considered success.
There's just this inner anger I feel. It's where I feel like they know that we'll keep watching and we'll keep supporting them because they know that sports radio is going to blow up and sport blogs and Twitter is going to get mad and reply at all their tweets with anger. But what I'm mad at about the Bears, the ownership, Ryan Pace, what I'm furious about, bro, is the fact that I don't want to say it's like an abusive relationship, but it's one of those where they know that we're just going to come back and watch. You know what I mean?
Uh-huh. Yeah, we're owned. We're completely owned. It unifies this town. Everybody watches on both sides of town, in the burbs and everywhere. They know there's nowhere else to go. When it really hurts them is when fans don't show. And there was no chance for anybody to do that and no chance for them to see that or feel that. And I hope to God that at least by middle of the football season, we're at 100% capacity so they can see if there's no shows, so they can feel it, because that does make a difference. There's been several different times in life where it does make a difference and often forces regime change. But yeah, they know. You know, here's the thing about the Bears, man. It's a family business. It is a family business, and nobody in the family has ever gotten good at the business. None of them, but the football part of it. Anyway, they've never gotten good at the business. But because it's the NFL and because they're a heritage franchise in a giant market like this, and because the revenue sharing is what it is and the TV deals are what it is, that you don't have to be very good at the family business to be successful. You don't have to be Art Rooney Jr. You can be George McCaskey or Michael before him and survive just fine. You know, you don't have to be the Maras as the Giants. You don't have to be Bob Kraft and then Jonathan Kraft. It's like if nobody in your family ever figures out how to be great at the football side of it, it still doesn't really matter in terms of success and sustainability in this league. That is the sad truth of the NFL.
You know what's funny is growing up, I would hear about the 85 Bears over and over again every year. 85 Bears, 85 Bears. And I think it was after Jay sort of failed in Chicago, quote unquote failed, is when I think the whole 85 Bears thing is just kind of an ancient relic of the past. Because don't you kind of remember like 1990s through maybe 09, everybody would kind of talk about it. And now it feels like everybody's kind of fed up with the fact that was our last really good team.
It seems ridiculous now. I think we've gone in phases with it. And maybe we've all landed at the place you're talking about now, where it just seems absurd that we're talking about, you know, 36 years ago. I mean, we've done the documentary. We had the 30 for 30 where they all wrote the letter to Buddy Ryan. You know, we've seen so many of them die. We've seen, you know, L.A. Mike Richardson is on trial for murder soon. You know, it's like it is ridiculous that we still look back on that as the pillar of the franchise, as like the greatest moment. Frankly, I find myself looking wistfully and longingly at the Eric Kramer years of 95, 96, when that offense was pretty good, you know, and they won a big playoff game against the Vikings. Those years, those like prime Wanstead years, which felt unsettling and perhaps unrewarding at the time, as the years go on, I'm looking back at it like, well, that was kind of fun. I wish we had some more of that, and let alone the Lovie Smith years, you know. So it's, I mean, part of that is just the very nature of history, and part of it is just the truly uninspiring present that we live in, as the offensive genius is just not that, as the GM wunderkind doesn't know quarterbacks to save his ass, and we all know it, and it's just brutal to watch them get a longer and longer leash when we don't really believe in these guys anymore.
I have this weird fascination with the Lovie Smith era, because like, I was younger, so I never really got to obviously meet him or anything, but he's one of those guys where I would love to just like get a beer with him and talk to him, because I feel like I could be wrong because I didn't work in the media, but I feel like we never really got to know the real Lovie, because he was so polarizing by not being polarizing, because literally every press conference was the same thing if they won, or it'd be different if they lost. And I feel like, not that we took it for granted, but now that we're like beyond mediocre, I just miss Lovie Smith. There was something about him that I found captivating.
I didn't find him captivating. I had a lot of respect for him because the players loved him, and the players busted their ass for him. He believed in them. They believed in him. And that's all that matters. It didn't matter how we, the media, felt. And I used to say that all the time. It's like, yeah, we can find him boring, but it just doesn't matter. But I didn't find him captivating because he was committed to being boring, man. He was committed to being uninteresting, similar to John Fox. It's really an old school football mentality. And I never got to know Lovie. I only talked to him a couple times on the radio. I know some guys who covered him very closely, and they don't feel like they ever got to know Lovie. Lovie just didn't really let people in. But his players loved him. They felt it. And that matters, man. Those defenses were great. And they found a way to make turnovers sustainable, which just it shouldn't even happen. But it did happen here because of the way they taught it, because of the peanut punch, and because of the relentlessness of that group and how they performed for each other and all of that. So much, much respect for Lovie, but I cannot agree on
I didn't mean captivating where he's like Pete Carroll dancing around. It was more, it was just weird to look at how he was so good at not saying anything. And he, it's almost like it takes more energy to be Lovie than to be like a Pete Carroll, like to just not say anything for like 10 years. I mean, that takes a lot of effort to just be that boy.
It's true. It's true. And it worked for him. Just remember how much those guys loved it, man. All of them. And they'll still tell you they do.
So I need you to teach me about what's going on with the Cubs and White Sox, because I cried for about 2 seconds when the Cubs won the World Series. And I felt like they were my team because nobody in St. Pete cared. And I haven't really watched them since. But now I want to get into baseball. So you and Danny on air, what have you guys been saying about like the baseball season this year? Because I am completely and utterly out of the loop.
Well, the White Sox are one of the most exciting teams in baseball. One of the coolest, most likable teams in baseball, perhaps aside from their manager, who was a very awkward hire at the age of 76 with lots of old school mentality, and the owner went over the GM's head to say, this, my old friend Tony La Russa, the manager. So that's weird. But the players, the roster, the makeup of the team, super fun, and they're going to be really, really good. So that's what it's about. for the most part in baseball in this town. And for the Cubs, it's like the third year in a row where we've gone into it saying this young core that Theo Epstein put together, this is their last dance together. Kyle Schwarber's already gone. The other four real true members of the offensive core, the young guys that kind of all came up together, Wilson Contreras, Anthony Rizzo, Javi Baez, Chris Bryant, three of them are free agents at the end of this year. Three of them. And Contreras is a free agent the year after that. So it's really about the start and where they are at the deadline. If things are ugly for the Cubs at the deadline, then a couple of those guys might get traded. And that includes the highest profile guys right there with Bryant. And some of them might get extended. But, the Cubs are trying to hang on. They're like the 89 Bears, man. That's what this is. Because as good as that year was, as great as that build was, as phenomenal as the rebuild was, as successful as Theo's regime was, it was one title and one trip to the World Series with a bunch of frustrations shortly thereafter. So this is, 5 years down the road after 2016 and maybe one final shot before they rebuild with clarity, which is not something they're admitting that they're doing, but a lot of the offseason moves have been doing. So there's some awkwardness here for the Cubs and a lot of attention here at the start, because that start could dictate how things go at the deadline for sure.
I can't figure out what happened with the Cubs. I feel like they kind of failed in a weird way. Like they won the World Series, but I mean, you don't have to win another World Series, but it just feels like they fizzled out fast. I feel like it was like the new 85 Bears. And what I'm afraid about, so I make sure that I keep up with Chicago sports. So I follow you guys on social media. I follow the local news, and I don't know if you ever think about this. Every year in late, when it's around the anniversary of the Cubs winning the World Series, Comcast Sportsnet will be like, today is the 3-year anniversary. Today is the 4-year anniversary of the Cubs winning the World Series. And I wrote this comment. I was like, way to live in the past, guys. And it got like 500 likes and all these people were mad at me. But I'm just like really afraid that we're never going to be present. And you can tell me if I'm wrong, because you're the one in Chicago and I'm very removed. But I feel like forever and ever, we're just going to be like, oh, it's the 14th. It's the 17th anniversary of the Cubs winning the World Series. And I'm very afraid that we're never going to be present again in the moment.
Well, it was pretty special, man.
Yeah.
It was a lot of years in the making. But I saw this with the Red Sox fan base. My dad has been a Red Sox fan since 1941, and I saw him wait a lifetime and get a championship in 2004 and then get grumpy again very quickly. It only took a couple years for the grumpiness to resume, and we're seeing it with the Cubs and with the fans that now a lot of them say, oh, this team stinks, and they're never going to do anything other than that 1 year. You know, so it's like all that talk about, just give me one before I die. Then people got their one, and now they're like, okay, just give me two before I die. I'd like three. So there's awkwardness around it for sure. But yeah, they'll keep celebrating it.
Forever.
I'm sure they will. They'll keep commemorating it. And frankly, it was pretty special. And I know you said you only cried for 2 seconds. It was powerful stuff, man. I don't know that I will ever find a season and a time and a team that I am more pleased to have been around for. You know what I mean? Like, I was super close to that team that year. I went to 4 World Series games as media and 2 of them as a fan. I was on the field at Wrigley after they won the National League against the Dodgers, on the field in Cleveland after they won the World Series, like checking these guys out and interviewing some of them. And it's like, here I am diving back into it. It was special. So you might just have to live with it, Ryan. You might just have to deal with it.
I think I got to just be cool with it. You know what I mean? I feel like I look at it very negatively, but it was just growing up. I was old enough to remember 98 and then obviously Bartman and then 07, 08. So then it was like, it was like the best sex you've ever had. And then after that, it's like, you're in the playoffs, it's fine, but it's like, it's never that one time. And I think that's what bothers me. But I mean, for you, were there any 1990s Bulls teams that sort of were equal to the feeling of the Cubs winning, or was the Cubs winning just its own animal?
Cubs was its own animal for me because of my baseball love. and because of how close I was to it at the time, we talked to Joe Madden every week, you know, and developed friendships there, that kind of thing. And so I just felt very connected to it in a different way. But the Jordan Bulls, man, that just defined swagger for a lot of us in anything that we did in the 90s. I mean, I was singing and making records and bartending and doing whatever the hell else while also producing and hosting occasionally in the 90s during those years. But this entire town was just feeling itself in a big, big way because we had the king. We had Muhammad Ali on a basketball court and everybody knew it in the world. So, and to have that backed up year after year after year was just like, see, I told you, like the collective swagger of this town probably was big in the Capone years and big in the Jordan years. And I don't know that we'll ever get back to it, frankly.
So I met Joe Madden one time. He came by my radio job about 6 years ago, and I met him. And I met him for 10 seconds, and it was the coolest 10 seconds that I've ever met somebody. He was so cool, and he barely said anything to me, and we took a picture. But I think out of everybody I've met, and I'm not name dropping, but I've met comics, I've met radio people, out of everybody I've ever met, there was this cool swagger where if it was anybody else that did what Joe Madden did, I would think he was too cool for the room. But the fact that he was really quiet was what made it so special, was he just was like an everyday guy.
Yeah, he's a cool dude. He just is. He's super curious. He's got a real active brain. He likes to have fun. He likes to be positive, and he's awfully smart. So yeah, it's the full package there for sure. And he's very, very approachable. That's for sure. And you know, his team is going to be really interesting, man. He's got Trout, and then, oh, by the way, Shohei Ohtani is going to be unlike anybody we've ever seen in baseball, throwing 101 miles an hour and leading off as he pitches. I mean, it's just crazy what we're going to see there. So I'm looking forward to it.
So I have a few more minutes with you. So what I want to ask you is, so I look at radio ratings because I'm a radio geek, and I'll look at different markets, and a lot of these towns, I mean, most of the sports radio is like barely got any shares. And in where you guys are at, you guys are doing very well. What has been the key for 670 to be a household name and for you guys 30 years later to keep on keeping on? What have you guys done right?
I think we've genuinely connected with the listeners. There are some listeners who don't like us and still listen.
Yes.
There are a lot of listeners who do like us and still listen and listen a lot. And we interact a lot. And I've gotten to be genuinely connected via social media or via our text lines or the caller lines or Facebook or whatever with a ton of people, ton of actual listeners. And as the world gets more and more isolated, live and local radio is a very special thing. And to be able to know that no matter what's going on in your day, that you can turn on the radio and get a certain vibe and certain voices talking to you in a certain way and welcoming you in, whether you agree or disagree. And you know that no matter how it goes, we're all going to be there again tomorrow. It's pretty special, man. So, you know, I think we all end up needing connection way more than we admit and perhaps realize at certain points in our lives. And this connection that the Score has and that I have with the listeners can feel oddly one way sometimes, but it's not really one way because people know you. You know, there are people out there who feel like they know me. They do know me. I mean, I try to be as close to myself as I can. So long answer, but that genuine connection, even aside from the sports, frankly, are a backdrop for the connection, in my opinion. So that's why it works as a medium.
Now, when it's all said and done, what do you want your legacy to be in radio?
Oh, God. I want it to be that I was entertaining, that I helped your day go by fast, that I helped people center themselves if they ever needed it, depending on stuff that was going on in their lives, and that I was not an a-hole, Ryan. I don't... You know, it's gone from wanting to be liked, which certainly was a driving force in my life early on, to now just simply wanting people to know I'm not an a-hole. Yeah. But not everybody's going to like me. You know, you can hate me, you can dislike me, you can not be a fan, whatever. That's cool. But I'm not an a-hole. There's lots of them out there, and the world has too many of them. So I don't want to be thought of as that.
There's that weird thing in sports radio where those guys that are like the loudest in the room, it's like, can you just turn it down a notch? What are you doing?
They're drawing attention. They're provoking emotion, and they're being encouraged to do so.
Yes.
And there's a lot of success. Hell, man, Skip Bayless has been a fraud and a charlatan for decades, and he's still making $8 million a year.
Ridiculous.
You know what I mean? It's outrageous. It's like, so, you know, I mean, more power to you, I suppose, if you can live with yourself and do that. But I like to try and be authentic. I couldn't imagine not being that way. You know what I mean?
So now, for people that haven't heard your show, what's it like and how can they tune in?
670thescore.com/listen. You can go to the radio.com app, which is what our corporate overlords at Entercom have put together. So you can listen to all radio.com stations throughout the country. Just choose Chicago and choose the Score. And it's me and Parkins. Danny Parkins is super smart, super thoughtful, has strong opinions, has a good sense of humor about himself. Thank God. Because he needs it. And then, and he and I get to kick it around and do live improv, essentially. We have a good time, try to make it conversational. We do get into meaty topics, but we also just have some fun with whatever's going on with our lives. And we do not ignore the cultural and occasional news world at large out there. But I just, I think you'll find genuine conversation, people having a good time, and really curious, interested sports fans. We both love it, man. We totally love it. He loves football more. I love baseball. We both love basketball. We're both passionate about, anything interesting in sports. So that's what we're always unearthing every day. It's fun.
Well, Matt, it's been a lot of fun having you on the show. It's very bizarre interviewing you because you were just a voice in my car when I was driving to Harper or when I was driving to John Hersey. So it's been a lot of fun having you on the show.
Ryan, a pleasure, man. Thanks for asking. Thanks for listening, and keep doing what you're doing. Enjoy yourself.
Awesome. Thank you, bro.
You got it, man.
All right, bye.
Hoppy, hoppy, hoppy. This is Hoppy Hour.